loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we talk about Brexit. The government of Prime Minister Theresa May in the United Kingdom was dealt a major blow today as members of parliament voted 432-202 to reject her deal, the one she negotiated on the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union. And then we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. That's a segment that takes place here on Loud and Clear every Tuesday.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump's choice to head the Justice Department, William Barr, begins his nomination hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Barr has pledged not to hamper or end the Mueller investigation, and he spent last week paying calls on committee members. He was previously Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush. Next, the New York Times reported today that a year ago, President Trump suggested to aides that the United States should withdraw from NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He made the statement several more times throughout 2018, calling it a financial drain on the U.S. A U.S. withdrawal would likely signal the end of the alliance. Then the Los Angeles teacher strike entered its second day today with no immediate end in sight. Why won't the L.A. Unified School District reduce class sizes, hire more nurses, counselors, and librarians, and give teachers a raise when the district is sitting on a $1.86 billion surplus? Today, huge pickets are continuing, and charter school teachers are joining the strike. And then today, we continue our regular segment, which we'll do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. And finally, Representative Steve King, a Republican of Iowa, will be stripped of his committee assignments because of racist comments he made last week. But King has been making similar comments for years, and the Republican leadership has never said a word. Senator Chuck Grassley even endorsed him for re-election last year. Why are the Republicans acting now? And does this mean the end of King's career? And in other headlines, Acting Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan approved a timeline of September 30th, 2019 for the troops at the U.S.-Mexico border to remain. The deployment of the U.S. military to the border was expected to last only until December 15th, 2018. The outgoing Israeli Defense Forces Army commander confirmed to the UK's Sunday Times that Israel has been funding Syrian right-wing militias. Until now, Israel has said it had only provided humanitarian supplies, and it had never admitted, despite pressure, that it had armed these groups as well. The commander also has recently acknowledged hundreds of IDF raids in Syria and dropping 2,000 bombs on Syria in 2018 alone. Today is Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. King would have been 90 years old today and is revered around the world for his leadership of the civil rights movement that brought down the system of Jim Crow segregation in the United States. King dedicated his life to fighting what he called the three evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, and he was assassinated in 1968. Turkish President Erdogan claimed today that he and President Trump had agreed to set up a security zone in northern Syria. The purpose of the zone would be to remove the presence of the Kurdish YPG militia, which Turkey considers to be a terrorist organization. The Turkish government has repeatedly threatened to launch yet another military incursion into Syria to wipe out the YPG presence along the border. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Brexit. The government of UK Prime Minister Theresa May was dealt a major blow today as members of Parliament voted 432-202 to reject the deal she negotiated on the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union. The survival of her government is very much in doubt, and the Brexit process has been thrown into even deeper chaos. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway and Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show, Walter Smolarek. George Galloway, Walter Smolarek, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Good to be here.
George Galloway, let's start with you. You are there in London. Just let's get the big picture takeaway. What are your thoughts right now?
Well, we use the word historic perhaps a little too freely, but this was truly historic. It was literally the worst defeat ever suffered by any British government on any matter in our entire history. And by some margin, the second biggest was the first Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, who was defeated by 166 votes after the now infamous Zinoviev letter, a forgery by British intelligence purporting to show that he, MacDonald, was acting under orders from the Kremlin in Moscow. Some things never change, Brian, and that might ring a bell or two. He lost by 166 votes, Theresa May by 230 votes, so the worst ever defeat. Now, immediately, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, equally often accused of being a Kremlin agent with no more justification than in the case of MacDonald, he stood up and moved a motion of no confidence tomorrow.
That's the voice of George Galloway. George and Walter, I want to play a clip from Theresa May. This was before the vote. It's about a minute and 37 seconds. That's not an about. It's 37 seconds. Let's listen. And then, George, I want to get your reaction.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. And people, particularly EU citizens who've made their home here, and UK citizens living in the EU, deserve clarity on these questions as soon as possible.
Order, there's no good people shouting. There will be an opportunity for other points of order, but the Prime Minister must and will be heard. The Prime Minister.
Those whose jobs rely on our trade with the EU need that clarity. So, with your permission, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to set out briefly how the government intends to proceed. First, we need to confirm whether this government still enjoys the confidence of the House. I believe that it does, but given the scale and importance of tonight's vote, it's right that others have the chance to test that question if they wish to do so. I can therefore confirm that if the official opposition table a confidence motion this evening in the form required by the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, the government will make time to debate that motion tomorrow. And if, as happened before Christmas, the official opposition declined to do so, we will, on this occasion, consider making time tomorrow to debate any motion in the form required from the other opposition parties, should they put one forward.
George Galloway, that was obviously Theresa May after she lost today, not before. Anyway, what happens next? She laid out some of the problems and challenges that she faces and the British government faces.
Well, first of all, she must cross the hurdle tomorrow by 7 o'clock in the evening of surviving a motion of no confidence in the House of Commons. Now, her erstwhile coalition partners, the Democratic Unionist Party, that's the Northern Irish version of the Ku Klux Klan, whose votes she depends on every day of the week, 10 of them, they'll have to come back on side with her, having abandoned her today. She'll also have to hope that some other MPs don't go missing in action just as the vote's being called. They don't disappear in a taxi somewhere, have a breakdown, get caught on a train that's late or whatever, because it will be very, very tight. But if we assume that she narrowly survives that no-confidence motion, that just prolongs the agony for her. She now has to go to Europe and say, I lost by an historic margin. What can you offer me that can turn that around? And because the margin was so great, it's very difficult to see why the European Union would even be bothered to entertain tweaking at the edges of an agreement that clearly has lost by a deluge. So we continue towards the default position, which is on the 29th of March, with or without a deal, we leave the European Union, in this case, without a deal.
George, you mentioned the DUP. That's the minority party from Northern Ireland. You analogize them to the KKK here in the United States, the Ku Klux Klan. They have 10 votes. Their vote is a requirement for Theresa May to maintain a majority position. They have announced that they will vote with her and not against her in the no confidence vote, even though they voted no on this particular Brexit deal. It seems to me, though, and I was talking with Walter earlier, her margin of error here is almost zero. I mean, one or two votes from her own party tips the scales, no?
Yes, and some who don't want Brexit at all might be persuadable to go missing or even to vote against her. Some of the 115 Conservative MPs who rebelled against her this evening and who had earlier voted no confidence internally inside the Conservative Party just last month against her, some of those might want to take the risk of voting for or at least facilitating this no confidence motion tomorrow in the belief that they would still have 14 days to bring forward an alternative Conservative leader who could demonstrate that they could command a majority in the House. So you're right to characterize it as a margin of error of close to zero.
That's the voice of George Galloway. George joins us from London. He is a legendary anti-war activist, a former British parliamentarian. George, Jeremy Corbyn, they're maybe waiting in the wings, the left wing of the Labour Party. The whole series of events, if we think back to the last couple of years, it's just been an amazing ride. I mean, you would think about, when we think about history, we think about bad mistakes, decisions of folly by political leaders or military leaders. And we also think about those in the context of larger historical moments, historical periods, and within the context of particular social systems. So it's this kind of integrated mix between the problems of decision makers and the problems of a social or economic order. At some points, they become toxic. We had the British government under the Tories calling for the Brexit referendum with the expectation that the majority would vote no. They would vote to remain inside the European Union, and that failed. We had a situation where Jeremy Corbyn suddenly came into the leadership of the Labour Party as a far left-wing, principled, internationalist, anti-imperialist person. And then Theresa May made another miscalculation, which was to call a snap election. And instead of it confirming and consolidating her hold on power, it did just the opposite. Every step along the way, you can see major, major miscalculations. But again, it's not simply the miscalculations of individuals absent a context. We are in a situation where the people in Britain and the people in other advanced industrial capitalist countries of the West are experiencing great, great social and economic problems and dislocations. Again, the consequence not of a particular politician, but a social order. And they are resentful and they are angry and they want change. It's this toxic combination of those kind of things. Go ahead.
Yeah, you've summarized it perfectly. And the mix is now joined. In France, the country is on fire. A virtual martial law has been declared. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the streets every day, every weekend, week after week, now going, I think, into the ninth week. There's a total blackout, by the way, in the so-called mainstream media in Britain of any news coverage of our closest neighbor. Where the early stages of a revolutionary situation have emerged. In your own country, a state of absolute stasis exists. Your government has shut down. You've got the police openly intriguing against the elected president. You've got generals practically mutinying. You've got the president serving up cold pizza to White House visitors because no one's at work in the White House. And all the while, these three leaders, Macron, May, and Trump, go around the world telling other people how to organize their countries whilst their own states are literally falling apart in governance. So we have now joined a blundering British Prime Minister, a brilliant Labour opposition leader who in Britain typifies, personifies the anti-establishment, anti-elite feeling that is abroad in most, if not all, advanced democratic capitalist polities. And Corbyn has played the parliamentary tactics of this with pristine precision, brilliance. And now he's got Theresa May over a barrel.
That's George Galloway. We're joined from London by George. He is a legendary anti-war activist, former British parliamentarian. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're talking, George Galloway, about Jeremy Corbyn. Let's listen to some of his comments today in British Parliament. There's two clips. I'm going to start with the first. It's about 1 minute long.
The debate today is the culmination of one of the most chaotic and extraordinary parliamentary processes I've ever experienced in my 35 years as a member of this House. Parliament has held the government in contempt for the first time ever for failing to publish their legal advice. Then, for the first time in a generation or more, on the 10th of December, a government failed to move its own business in the House. The government has been defeated on a vote in its own finance bill for the first time since the 1970s. The Prime Minister opened the debate on her deal more than 1 month ago, a debate that was due to end on the 11th of December, but she pulled it in a panic. As she herself conceded, it would have been rejected by a significant margin. She has run down the clock in a cynical attempt to strong-arm members into backing her deal. Yep.
All right, and then before we go on, I want to hear one more clip. This is Jeremy Corbyn. It's about 10 seconds long, amazing clip, and it's right after the vote.
Can give its verdict on the sheer incompetence of this government and pass that motion of no confidence in the government.
A different emotive context right there, George Galloway. Jeremy Corbyn says sheer incompetence, that this decision was the verdict on a government of sheer incompetence, and he calls for a motion of no confidence in the government. Just, again, help us Americans who don't and won't know what really happens in Britain. We don't understand our own government, so certainly it's going to be hard for people here to understand how the British government works. What would happen if a no-confidence vote actually takes place and Theresa May loses? What happens then?
Then because we have a fixed-term Parliament Act now, which means each Parliament must last 5 years, the governing party has 14 days to come up with an alternative to the Prime Minister, to go to the palace, ask the Queen to allow them to form a government and persuade the Queen that they can command a majority in the House. Now, that is a very high-wire act. That's why it's probably the case that no Tories will vote with Corbyn tomorrow in the no-confidence vote. But it can be ruled out because there are many contenders for Theresa May's crown. The streets of London are full of putative leadership campaigns, setting up offices, requiring phone lines, setting up Twitter handles and all the rest. So some of their supporters might take the view that if the Tories lose the no-confidence vote tomorrow, that within the next 14 days, they can put together a new regime. But if they can't persuade the Queen of it, the Queen will dissolve Parliament and there will be a 3.5-week campaign, a new general election. And all the signs are the bookmakers, the opinion polls, the pundits, the terror in the eyes of the enemy are that the anti-imperialist with whom I sat in Parliament for almost 30 years, Jeremy Corbyn, would be Britain's new Prime Minister.
That's hard to believe, almost. I mean, back in 2013, in January 18th, 2003, 16 years ago now, the Answer Coalition, of which I'm still the national director, organized a demonstration of about 500,000 people down in the mall against the pending, looming U.S. invasion of Iraq. We had almost no American politicians come, I think one. And even though we had 500,000 people in the streets, still maybe one, Jeremy Corbyn, at his own expense and after our invitation, flew from London to Washington to address the crowd. That's Jeremy Corbyn, Walter. I mean, that's who this person is. George Galloway, likewise, legendary anti-war, anti-imperialist figure. The idea that Jeremy Corbyn could take the helm. And let's just think about how this all came to be. In many ways, the process in the UK where Corbyn had this sudden rise was the consequence really of young people. And then you think back to the 2016 election, Bernie Sanders, and Sanders is far to the right of Jeremy Corbyn. But again, he ran as a self-pronounced socialist. And in America, where the unofficial religion of the country is anti-communism and has been such since 1946, it was amazing that he was getting 80% of the youth vote. So we have these different tendencies, a dislocation, destabilization at the top, as George Galloway has aptly put it, in France, in the UK, in the United States. But there is this other yearning for change, real change, from mainly young people who are making a difference. In some ways, a Corbyn ascension would have a huge impact on politics, not only in the UK, maybe not only in France, but right here.
Yeah, and I think it's true that, you know, not only was Jeremy Corbyn's election as leader of the Labour Party in the first place, in large part due to the enthusiasm of young voters, but, you know, his protection from a coup from within his own party is in large part, I think, due to the, I believe, hundreds of thousands of young people who signed up to join the Labour Party and therefore would get to vote in a leadership election. So, you know, the crisis, especially since the 2008 Great Recession, of really the capitalist system, has hit young people especially hard. Unemployment, and especially underemployment, the inability to find full-time work, decent paying work, that's something that's really devastated young people all around the world. And so, you know, there's a progressive impulse and there's a reactionary impulse. You know, there's people who support, you know, say Donald Trump or the National Front in France. But there's also this left-wing progressive pro-socialist impulse that's much, much stronger among young people that Jeremy Corbyn and, you know, to a less anti-imperialist extent, Bernie Sanders represents as well.
George Galloway, I was reading, I can't remember, it was this morning, I can't remember if it was the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but they sent a reporter to a pub somewhere in the heart of what had been historically the British industrial heartland, where people actually voted to leave. They voted for Brexit. And they went through the pub, this reporter, and to the last man and woman, every one of them were completely unfazed about the prospects of a Brexit without a deal. They made the point that the people in Britain had endured the Nazi bombing in World War II, that this wasn't that big of a deal, that all of the alarm being sounded about a no deal was just that, an alarm. Will there be another Brexit referendum, though? And if so, what would be the outcome?
I don't think there will be. It would risk social peace in the country to be so, in the absence of the decision of the first referendum being implemented. It would negate democracy. It would infuriate millions of people who are the people who don't have much to lose from leaving the European Union. If they can't get their Roquefort cheese imported from France, except with a big tariff on it, that won't trouble them, for they don't eat Roquefort cheese because they can't afford it. If Mercedes cars are priced farther out of their reach, they won't care about that because they can't afford the Mercedes anyway. The Brexit result, as I've been telling you for more than 2 years now, was a revolt of our own sans-culottes. It was a revolt of the people whose lives under 45 years of neoliberal economics, austerity, and the capitalist tenets of the European Union are really quite dire. The industrial heartlands, as you described them, are now the industrial wastelands, rust belts, you call them, in the United States. Why should anyone living there have any affection for an economic bloc which presides over, has presided over, indeed helped to dictate their own decline. So the British state can try, if it likes, to cheat those people out of what they voted for. But I promise you, if they do, it'll make events in France look like a tea party.
George Galloway, it's been more than a decade since the Great Recession began, really a depression for, I don't know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people worldwide. We've had a decade without a recession. This is the economic expansion phase of the boom-bust cycle. We're booming. The stock market's booming. I mean, it was 6,600 in 2009 in March when Obama took office. It's now about 24,000. It's booming. What happens when the recession comes? Because, of course, that's the flip side of this boom-bust cycle. When you think about all of these working-class communities and people who have been harmed and have not recovered during the recovery, I mean, anyway, we have a minute left. I know you have a crystal ball. How do you see things folding out?
Well, the old world is dying. The new is struggling to be born, and many morbid symptoms have emerged. And we may yet live in the time of monsters. But I believe that the old world cannot be revived. It is stricken fatally with its flaws, and those flaws are no longer tolerable for the mass of the people. It's incoherent. Some people, as Walter said, move right, some move left, but all of them are moving against the prevailing orthodoxy. The prevailing orthodoxy now belongs in a glass case marked Dodo, extinct, a dead parrot.
That's George Galloway. Walter, 10 seconds left. What about your crystal ball? I mean, again, you know, as a younger person, there's so much anger and resentment and at the same time hope in the return of idealism among young people. What do you think? 10 seconds.
Well, I think that if Jeremy Corbyn goes on the campaign trail, if there is a snap election called, I think that his support will only grow because the program that he is putting forward is the only one among the major politicians in the UK that actually addresses the real concerns that young people, working class people, oppressed people have.
Yeah, and I also think it'll have a tsunami political effect here in the United States. Anyway, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. This segment appears every Tuesday on Loud and Clear. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, of course, this topic is relevant to everyone. Some people may say, well, I don't know much about international politics. Some people might say, I don't know much about politics outside of my own local area. Some people might think, hey, I really don't know how to explain economics. But the fact of the matter is, what happens in the economy affects every single person in the most direct way. And that's why this segment with Daniel Sankey is so important, because
yeah.
It takes the issues that affect us every day, and we try to explain it. We try to understand it. We're not presenting the way the Wall Street Journal business section does, because, of course, their readership, their constituency are basically investors, basically people who are at the top end of the economy. We're talking about what working class and poor people especially need to know about the economy. That said, Daniel, what's our first story?
I think a first story that we should start talking about is the PG&E bankruptcy. So PG&E is being blamed, and I think rightly so, for causing the record wildfires in California over the last 2 years. I think that on one hand, I completely support that assessment, and I believe that's accurate. There was some negligence on their part that I'm going to go into in a moment. But I think the larger picture, of course, is climate change. It's systemic. It's not just PG&E that did this. It's the fact that our climate is rapidly changing and becoming more dangerous and uninhabitable for humans, and that the trickle-down effect, at least in California, was these huge wildfires. So PG&E, what they're alleging is that PG&E has a number of exposed power lines that crisscross the United States that are out in the open, and they were encroached upon by vegetation. The vegetation, of course, became very dry by record lack of rainfall and record, you know, high temperatures. And when very high winds hit, which were also a result of climate change because of the lack of vegetation, it caused a lot of these power lines to get knocked down, causing sparks, causing small explosions. Normally, these wouldn't be such a big deal. It might be a small fire at worst. But in the context of very dry vegetation and record lack of rainfall, this created huge wildfires. Now, PG&E was aware of these issues. These issues had been surfaced by other regulatory bodies that had pointed out, you need to put these power lines underground. They're not safe up here. You need to start preparing for these, you know, change in the climate. PG&E pushed it off to the side, decided not to make those changes, figured either it had more time or that it wasn't worth all the money they were going to pay or that the risks were overblown. And, of course, that's very wrong. It's facing more than $30 billion in potential liability. This includes also tons of lawsuits from people who have lost their entire communities and homes to these raging wildfires. And so now it's entering bankruptcy proceedings because the state has basically concluded there's no way they'd ever be able to bail it out. They wouldn't be able to do it in sufficient time. It would take years, and it would take probably more money than the state can do. So PG&E is this odd sort of public-private company. It kind of has a certain monopoly on electricity and gas here in California, where that's the only one you can go to. And yet it's a publicly traded company. If you look up this article in the Wall Street Journal, it'll show you a little ticker symbol next to it. So investors can dump money into it if they want to. So it's, you know, it kind of gets played off as a sort of public utility in California, when in fact it is a very private utility and has very strong profit incentives, which is, I'm sure, a big part of why those repairs went unheeded, because it costs money to put wires underground. It's very expensive. It's a big infrastructure overhaul. And investors don't like that because they want that money to go into their pockets, not into redoing the infrastructure so that it can be safer for people.
I have to tell you, too, I subscribe to Barron's. Don't ask me why. I don't have any money to invest, but I subscribe to Barron's. And just before these fires, Barron's featured PG&E as one of their weekly stocks to buy. And the reason they said that was because PG&E was flush with cash. And while there are occasional fires in California, they have enough cash to pay off whatever settlements the courts will force them to pay. Nobody outside PG&E envisioned a fire of this magnitude, of this scope. PG&E should have, because as Daniel points out, they didn't even bother to trim the vegetation. It's no wonder that this fire took place. It's a miracle that a fire of equal intensity and size didn't take place earlier.
And more will in the future.
And more will, that's right.
But yeah, so let's talk about that. And Daniel, let's PG&E is Pacific Gas and Electric. Okay, so it's a profit-making corporation. And they have a monopoly hold on the delivery of services. If they declare bankruptcy, do they go out of business or do they just end up not paying their creditors?
The second. So what they do is they don't have to pay their creditors. They get special legal protections that basically say, even though it's our fault, even though we did something bad, we won't pay you because we're protected by these laws. It will continue as a corporation because we need gas and electricity in California to power it. So it won't, cease functioning. You know, I shouldn't be surprised by, but what I always like to point out is, you know, sort of like when the banks, you know, almost destroyed our economy back in 2008, this was a prime opportunity for politicians to step forward and take some bold actions because they had really screwed things up. And that goes for PG&E. This would be a great opportunity to take it public or to do something of that nature to say, your presence in our state is too essential to our infrastructure, has such a huge impact on the citizens here that it's not safe having you be a private company that's just beholden to small groups of investors. That's very dangerous because that's what ended up with these out of control wildfires. There'd be tremendous political will for it. You know, everybody hates PG&E in California right now. There's nobody that feels like it's not their fault or is trying to defend it, except maybe probably some corporate lawyers or lobbyists. But of course, you don't hear that conversation. What you hear is, well, I guess they'll go bankrupt and people won't get their paid out because they have this special legal protection. And that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, the PG&E CEO, John, has resigned as it goes into bankruptcy. I feel so sorry for the CEO. She had to resign. Oh, wait, Wait, she's getting a severance package. It's $2.5 million for this great job done. I mean, $2.5 million doesn't say compared to sort of executive CEO pay, but as a severance package, John,
sweet.
If you know, something happened to your job and you got a severance package, you had to leave and you only took $2.5 million with you, it sort of softens the blow.
I think it does. It does soften the blow a little bit, at least. She'll be okay.
How about the lack of any sort of criminal charges or civil liability?
No, you're rewarded. You're given $2.5 million.
Just not going to jail would be a reward enough. And yeah, you're rewarded with $2.5 million. And who knows how much she made, functioning as a CEO, I'm sure many millions. But that's exactly right. What's the incentive for someone like her, for the next CEO, to really do anything? You know, what's going to happen? They might get $1 million and have to step down and go retire in Boca or something like that. And the truth is, she could probably get another job in some executive position in another corporation pretty easily. But the fact of the matter is, there's no reason for these executives to behave ethically or to feel like they have some kind of obligation to California or Californians, because they're going to get that golden parachute. Nobody's going to come after them with any sort of legal liability. I mean, imagine if you went to jail for it. You know, boy, you'd start seeing executives getting whipped into shape real quick. If I committed arson and burned down my neighbor's house, I could go to jail for years, right? But if through gross negligence, I just ignore and burn down entire cities, I get $2.5 million and say, ooh, I'm really sorry. My heart goes out to the people who lost their homes, which is essentially what the PG&E CEO has done.
Before the fires, I'm looking back at the Mercury News. Geisha Williams, PGE CEO, now retiring with only a $2.5 million severance. Her pay for the year before was $8.6 million. $8.6 million. And here the customers, well, let's face it, it's the people. Why call us customers? We're reduced to the status of customer as part of the commodity exchange. Like when you go to a hospital now, you're a customer.
Yeah.
You're not like a sick person. You're actually a customer. You're a guest. You're a guest. You're a guest who's going to pay some money.
Right.
You know, like a certain kind of hospitality regime where the guest pays. But nonetheless, I mean, here's a situation where the people are really basically held hostage by these kind of so-called utility companies, because they are profit-making investors, investments for profit-driven and profit-seeking investors on Wall Street. Again, too big to fail, because ultimately, the boss has to leave with a $2.5 million golden parachute. The company doesn't have to pay its debts. It doesn't have to pay a lot of what it owes people who may have lost everything in this fire. Or it's not a fire. It was 17 fires. And again, they go right back to business as usual, where PG&E exercises complete domination over the market and the customers, also known as the people.
Yeah, I mean, cynically speaking, if I was an investor, I would. It's lost about half of its value, PG&E stock price. I would consider this a good time to buy, because where else are people going to do for electricity and gas, right? I mean, it's not like it has a competitor that other people are going to go to. It can do a horrific job and, you know, cut all kinds of costs, and I could buy it at half price right now. And I don't know, over the next 5 years or so, it'll probably continue to do well and turn out a profit. People will hate it, but, you know, people hate the banking industry and it's still there. So that's the so-called free market we have here, is we have the freedom to either not have gas and electricity or to do business with PG&E while they rip us off by declaring bankruptcy and give their CEOs a $2.5 million golden parachute when they quit.
What does PG&E actually give people? I'm interested in what they actually provide outside of sending people their bills. Because, you know, like when you look at Pepco and you drill down and see what the services are that Pepco basically is providing, a lot of the people who are doing basic work, core work, and providing electricity or gas, they're not even PG&E employees. A lot of them are subcontractors. In other words, PG&E is just sort of a vessel to collect money and to reward investors with additional money.
Yeah, they kind of have a special legal status that they get to provide this utility that everybody needs to function on a basic level, and nobody else can. You know, you could kind of compare it to the only the Fed can print the United States dollar. You know, technically anyone could print it with the right technology, but only they have the legal right. And PG&E kind of enjoys that too. And one way, you know, it maximizes its profits is those subcontractors that you mentioned. So PG&E doesn't actually do the work, but it can hire anybody it wants to do the work. And those people do it. And of course, you know, subcontracting, they really grind down the wages of the people who are actually out there, you know, setting up infrastructure, or fixing things, or, you know, digging new trenches to input new things, et cetera. And, you know, that's a big part of how they make that profitability, because they have that special legal status. Other people can't go set up a power plant, start generating electricity, put some cables in it, and then go door to door and say, hey, you want to buy my electricity? That would be illegal. And so that's really all it gets, is it just has a special kind of legal status that other people don't enjoy. And that's why it gets to enjoy its monopoly power.
Daniel Sankey, another story that you shared with us, and you said this one is a big one, as companies report earnings for 2018, we're going to see how big an impact the trade war will have. Paren, it will be big, close paren. Let's talk about that story.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So as we know, 2018 is behind us, and all these major corporations are going to put out earnings reports shortly of how they did in the fourth quarter and just how they did overall in 2018. Although this might be slowed down a bit, as the government shutdown is preventing a lot of economic data from being produced that they might rely on for their projections. So maybe that'll stall it. I'm not sure. But eventually they will come out with it because their investors demand it and they're required to. We're going to see how these major corporations have fared under a regime in which China has been tariffed heavily by the Trump administration, and also where even ally countries like Canada and Europe have faced tariffs. This is going to have a trickle-down effect to the rest of the corporations, and we're going to start seeing how it comes out. So I know we're not supposed to, you know, shine our crystal ball up and predict the future, but I think we're going to start seeing in real hard dollars and cents the impact of these tariffs, because it's very, at first, it doesn't seem to do much. It's sort of like the government shutdown. In the first 5 days or something, it doesn't seem to change. Nothing really matters. And I think most citizens sort of look the other way and say, oh, well, it's just a bunch of idiots in Washington fighting. The same thing with a tariff war. We hear about all these tariffs and we go to the store and we buy milk and it's the same price of milk. And we kind of think, oh, okay. But as a longer term effect, it will have big and dramatic impacts. And that this is going to be the start of it. Those companies are going to report more poor profitability than they planned on, I anticipate. And this will in turn impact a lot of other things. We've seen so much volatility in the stock market. This is going to increase that volatility because a lot of people are going to feel like, oh my gosh, these were our fears confirmed. It's really hurting, you know, Wall Street. It's really hurting the big corporations. So we're going to see investors pulling more money out as they kind of panic and seek to find areas that the tariffs aren't impacting in an economic way. And of course, there's going to be the trickle down social effects, you know, for workers who might face cuts in pay, might face layoffs, cuts in benefits, as these companies try desperately to inflate their numbers and try to make them more profitable. Now, the GOP tax plan will kind of dampen that effect somewhat, because all these corporations are going to get a huge tax break. So what they probably anticipated having to pay is going to be much less than what they actually have to pay, because I think a lot of them didn't see the GOP tax plan coming. So that'll help a little bit in terms of profitability. But I think their outlook, their forecast, which is what they're also going to have to report, you know, what do they think 2019 is going to look like, is going to be pretty bleak. And so we're going to start seeing that as they roll out those facts and figures, which I think has just kind of been delayed at this point due to the government shutdown.
We don't hear much from what China is saying and the Chinese are saying. I'm looking at the Global Times. I want to read a couple sentences and get your response to this. And it's about Chinese direct investment in the United States. We hear a lot about foreign direct investment, including U.S. investment in China since China's opening in 1978. But China's been investing a lot in the United States, and it has both positive and negative impacts on people. But here's what the Global Times writes. Sluggish Chinese investment in the U.S. last year resulted mostly from tougher U.S. screening of high technology acquisitions and is set to persist this year, analysts noted on Tuesday, suggesting that China should expand investment in other markets like Russia to strike a balance. Okay, several reports released in a recent day by international consultancies and law firms showed that China's outbound investment in the U.S. has been hit hard by the dark clouds hanging over bilateral relations. And here's the kicker. According to a report released by the New York-based research company Rhodium Group on Sunday, China's foreign direct investment in the United States, including greenfield investments and acquisitions, slumped by how much in the last year? 84% on a yearly basis to $4.8 billion in 2018, the lowest level in 7 years, and a dramatic decline from $46 billion in 2016. So the Chinese companies invested $46 billion in the U.S. in 2016. 2018, it was $4.8 billion. Those are dramatic numbers.
Those are extremely dramatic. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. One of them is, you know, China, what you'll see in the U.S. is, you know, this kind of nationalistic chauvinism sometimes where you'll where people say, oh, buy American, you know, buy an American car, buy an American truck, because, you know, you're not giving your money to foreigners, you're giving it to the United States. And that sort of rhetoric actually works and it resonates. And it's definitely been ad campaigns in the past. There's similar things in China. Your average Chinese consumer and average Chinese purchaser see what's going on with the U.S. And frankly, we look horrible. We look completely unreasonable, erratic, unreliable, untrustworthy. And there's a lot of consumers that are sort of saying, I don't know if we really want to do business there. I mean, come on, we're proud of our country and look how they're treating us. But then it goes further because the big investors that have the billions of dollars that we talk about, they're seeing what we're doing with sanctions and with seizure of funds. So the second Huawei executive was arrested, I believe, in the last few days.
In Poland,
yeah. So the CFO was arrested of this massive corporation. Now another executive's been arrested. Now, if you're an investor dumping money into the U.S. and the U.S. is snagging other investors and throwing them in prison, you might start worrying about your investment. You might start saying, what if they say, hey, any Chinese money in here is ours. We're grabbing it through sanctions laws. We're going to force the banks to freeze those accounts. We've certainly done it before with other countries like Iran or Russia. There's no reason why we do it with China. So if you're an investor, you're going to think to yourself, this is not safe. As a Chinese investor, I'm going to get my money stolen or something like that. And then you start thinking about diversification. What countries are very friendly to China or at least non-hostile? And you start looking at them. So you start putting your money into those environments because you know Russia's not going to seize it and, you know, it could potentially turn a profit. Now, they'd rather put it in the U.S., but we're destroying so much trust and creating such an unstable trade environment that they're going to stop doing this. So that's a big part of the kind of globalization, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, is yes, China does enjoy a huge economic boost due to cheap labor and really permissive laws around foreign U.S. capital. But at the same time, they also give it back here to the tune of billions of dollars. And now, as you can see, we're seeing that outflow because investors don't trust it. And that's going to ultimately, at the end of the day, really impact workers here because that money does go into companies and corporations here that are employing U.S. workers that are indirectly creating inputs and products that U.S. companies use, which in turn creates profitability for them and the ability to hire more workers and give them better pay, et cetera. So this connected economies between us. We're so integrated between us and China that we're only beginning to see those changes. But boy, that 84% drop, that's massive in such a short period of time. And I anticipate we'll probably see it continue because as far as I've seen, there's no silver lining on the China-U.S. trade talks. I haven't seen anything really positive coming out of it recently.
And what does all this do for international or global, I should say, growth? We know that the Chinese economy is slowing down anyway. We know that our own economy is at least steady, maybe slowing down. This has to portend a global recession, no?
Yeah, that's certainly what's been on the radar of a lot of economists. They've been talking about an upcoming global recession. You know, part of it is the trade war. It certainly aggravates it and accelerates it. But the truth is, you know, ever since 2008, you know, the Wall Street Journal likes to say it's been an economic expansion, which is technically true. But I don't think anybody living in 2009 would feel like, you know, happy days are here again. It was simply an expansion because once you're at rock bottom, you can only go up. So any increase at that point is technically an expansion and improvement. Depressions under capitalism allow for profitability to be recreated. So if you can't make any money and everything's too expensive, a horrible economic collapse causes everything to be cheap. So you can buy in cheap and it's easier to profit, which is what we saw since 2008. And now we're reaching the natural end of that cycle. You know, the Fed is raising rates. They're talking about ending quantitative easing and pulling back on it. The trade war is further aggravating it, making things more expensive than they need to be. And of course, investors want cheap, reliable investments. And the Trump administration has taken this very aggressive global stance, which is to see virtually every country out there as some sort of competitor and enemy, including longtime allies. You know, all these factors together produce a really unstable environment and I think accelerate the possibility of a global recession. I think we're seeing just the start of it now, but we'll definitely start seeing it more aggressively in 2019.
Important points. We're talking with Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday about the big economic stories of the week. And the economic stories are also political stories and vice versa. Again, talking about Poland, the Polish government is an ally of the U.S. government. The U.S. is incorporating Poland into NATO. And
it's the new Europe.
Yeah, the new Europe. The old Europe is Western Europe. The new Europe is the former socialist bloc nations who are now becoming incorporated, have been incorporated into NATO. They arrested this Huawei sales executive. And Huawei had done a lot of business in Poland. I mean, since in the last 15 years, a major, huge Chinese technology company doing a lot of business in the U.S., making smartphones, doing a lot of business in Eastern Europe, including Poland. The Polish government arrested this guy, charged him with espionage, which is a high-level charge. And now what's going to happen, we don't know. But Poland obviously will be retaliated against by China. They have to because they can't let their executives like just dangle like that. And again, this leads back to the story we're talking about. Chinese executives and Chinese corporate leaders have to decide, do I want to actually do business not only in the West, not only in the United States, but even in the East Europe, where countries are under the influence and pressure of the United States? And again, a country like Poland, it's a big country. It's got a big economy, but it's not as big, say, as Canada. But Canada, too, I was reading the sort of analysis of a former government, Canadian government official, and he said Canada's like the meat in a meat sandwich, meaning you have the Chinese on one side of the sandwich and the Americans on the other side. So the U.S. orders the arrest of the Huawei chief financial officer in Vancouver, in Canada, for extradition to the United States when she's changing planes. The Canadian government, under pressure from the U.S., holds her. Then China arrested two Canadian citizens. They didn't arrest Americans. And now I'm looking at the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It's a picture of Robert Schellenberg. He's a Canadian who's been in jail in China for 4 years for drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
The China just had another trial.
Yeah. In fact, he was sentenced to 15 years and he appealed because he thought that was too long.
Too long. So they retried him and they've just sentenced him to death.
Right.
So the picture of Robert Schellenberg on the front page of the Wall Street Journal is Chinese court sentences Canadian to death. It's a picture of Schellenberg sitting in a Chinese courtroom. Yeah, guess what? China's not going to just be a punching bag. And this has a destabilizing impact on people, a destabilizing impact on travel, foreign investment. And guess what? We live in an interconnected world and what goes around comes around. That's what you're saying, Daniel. In other words, there's maybe the law of unintended consequences. You start doing one thing, you haven't thought it through completely to the end. Maybe it feels good to lash out at China, but then have you looked two or three or four steps down the road to see what the consequences are?
Yeah, and I think Canada is starting to realize that, and Poland will as well. The truth is that if you're just a purely profit motivated person, if you look at what China is doing in Poland and the investment it's putting in it and the business is doing with it, it's extremely attractive. And the only reason why they're cracking down on China in this way and taking such dramatic steps is because, you know, the current heads of state are these sort of pseudo-fascist, very fascist-friendly governments that are just completely within the circle of the United States, just completely behoven to the U.S. empire ideologically, and will take very stupid actions that will ultimately hurt their countries based on ideology, based on this anti-communist, anti-Chinese kind of racist nationalism. And they feel a kinship with the Trump administration, which is what we're seeing in Poland now. I think one of their heads of state was recently marching in some national parade, which was attended by 10,000 neo-Nazi groups or 10,000 neo-Nazi participants or something like that.
Yeah, Warsaw.
Yeah, in Warsaw. So that's the ideological framework, which is, hysterically anti-communist, so sees China as an enemy, and, hysterically pro-Western, and so wants to draw itself into U.S.'s orbit.
Daniel, we have just under 2 minutes. I want to go to one more story. There's many more stories. Maybe we'll come back to the ones we didn't get to next week. Research details the rapid increase in homelessness in certain U.S. cities. We've talked about this before, but let's talk about this story on our way out.
Absolutely. So homelessness is exploding in major urban centers. Certainly, I see it on a daily basis here in the United States. But the rent prices are continuing to rise for lower income Americans. It estimates that 553,000 people were homeless for a period of time in 2018. That's more than 500,000 people experienced homelessness. I know in New York, for example, 1 in 10 children are homeless, which is insane. And I imagine the figures are very similar here in California. Certainly in San Francisco, some of my friends who are educators have fellow peer educators who live out of their cars because they can't afford to live anywhere else. So they're sitting here teaching children, living out of their cars on the side. This is a nationwide phenomenon, though. These urban centers are becoming these highly competitive places with the only opportunity for any sort of income or job as kind of the non-urban centers get hollowed out and lack the opportunity to create, real economic infrastructure that would allow for jobs to be there. So everybody's racing into the cities trying to make a buck, and it's causing these rent prices to spiral out of control to where they are just unmanageable. People are commuting, hours and hours a day, getting up at 4 a.m, 3 a.m, just to make it to work. And even in spite of all that, we're rolling back protections. We're rolling back rent stabilization measures, which are causing people who, live pretty simple lives, very humble lives, but could have had a home. And I'm seeing this in Oakland. People like that who then had a whole bunch of public assistance roll back on them, and now they're homeless, totally destitute, living in tents on the side of the street. This is a national epidemic.
It is a national epidemic. We're going to keep following that and these other stories. This is our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You can hear it every Tuesday here on Loud and Clear. Daniel Sankey is a financial policy analyst. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.